And here is the Vegan's Almanac for today, the 4th of January. It's the birthday of Sir Isaac Newton, born on this day in 1643. Newton is considered to be the father of physics and one of the greatest scientists to live since the 17th century. His ideas have become the foundation of modern physics, and he is best known for the laws of gravity and the concepts of universal gravitation, centrifugal force, centripetal force, and the effects of bodies in motion. Newton was a vegetarian, mainly in the last years of his life. He expressed deep compassion for animals and was a fervent animal lover. He invented cat doors. A contemporary of Newton's, the French Enlightenment writer Voltaire, wrote about Newton's compassion for animals, quote, "Newton had cultivated the compassion of humanity, and he extended it to the lower animals. With Locke, he was strongly convinced that God has given to them a proportion of ideas and the same feelings which he has given to us. He could not believe that God, who has made nothing in vain, would have given to them organs of feeling in order that they might have no feeling. He thought it a very frightful inconsistency to believe that animals feel and at the same time to cause them to suffer." Today is also the birthday of Joyce Tischler, born on this day in 1935. Joyce Tischler, affectionately known as the mother of animal law, is the co-founder of the Animal Legal Defense Fund and was ALDF's executive director for 25 years. Professor Tischler is internationally recognized for her trailblazing work in launching the field of animal law. In 2008, through collaborations between the Animal Legal Defense Fund and the Lewis and Clark Law School, the Center for Animal Law School was founded. Professor Tischler taught there to help educate the next generation of animal lawyers. Joyce Tischler, who said, "The field of animal law has grown throughout the world. There are lawyers in Europe, Asia, Africa, South America, Australia, New Zealand. Everywhere that there are animals, there are now lawyers who are protecting animals. I have faith that we will be in a world where animals have rights someday. I look forward to a world in which we don't eat them, we don't torture them, we don't use them or exploit them, where we allow them to be who they are. A vegan, cruelty-free world in which our brethren have lives that are meaningful to them." The publication of Animal Rights, What Everyone Needs to Know by Paul Waldau was on this day in 2011. Waldau looks at the different concerns surrounding companion animals, wild animals, research animals, work animals, and animals used for food, provides a no-nonsense assessment of the treatment of animals, and addresses the philosophical and legal arguments that form the basis of animal rights. Along the way, readers will gain insight into the history of animal protection, as well as the political and social realities facing animals today, and become familiar with a range of hot-button topics, from animal cognition and autonomy to attempts to balance animal cruelty versus utility. Chronicled here are many key figures and organizations responsible for moving the animal rights movement forward, as well as legislation and public policy that have been carried out around the world in the name of animal rights and animal protection. The final chapter of this indispensable volume looks ahead to the future of animal rights and delivers an animal protection mandate for citizens, scientists, governments, and other stakeholders. And the publication of Animals Are Not Ours. No, really, they're not. An Evangelical Animal Liberation Theology by Sarah Withrow King was on this day in 2016. Why should Christians care about animals? Is there a biblical basis for abstaining from eating animals? Is avoiding companies that use and misuse animals a viable way for Christians to better live out the message of God? In Animals Are Not Ours, Sarah Withrow King makes the argument that care for all of creation is no far-fetched idea that only radical people would consider, but rather a faithful witness of the peaceful kingdom God desires and Jesus modeled. This includes all living and breathing creatures that share this earth with us. King uses her decade-plus experience as a vegan, her seminary education, her evangelical Christian faith and her years working with PETA to call Christians to examine how we treat and view the non-human animals with whom we share a finite planet. And here's a quote from Isaac Newton for today. I keep the subject of my inquiry constantly before me and wait till the first dawning opens gradually by little and little into a full and clear light. A quote by Sir Isaac Newton. This has been the Vegan's Almanac with a reminder that animals have lives that are meaningful to them. Welcome to Animalia Hour, a full hour of news and stories related to non-human animals, as well as the joyful and healthful benefits of plant-based eating. I am your host, Sarah Hale. Thank you for being here. Today we're reading Chapter 3 from Howard Lyman's book, Mad Cowboy, Plain Truth from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat. Chapter 3 is titled, Improving on Nature. My great-grandfather owned and operated a mid-sized organic dairy farm outside of Great Falls, Montana. My grandfather took the farm over from him, and my father took it over from my grandfather. I knew from the time I was knee-high to a grasshopper that someday that farm would belong to me and my brother. When I was 3 or 4 years old, my mother used to wake me up at dawn and bring me to the cow barn in order, I suppose, to have someone to talk to as she milked the cows. One of my earliest memories is of walking too close to the back end of a cow and getting kicked pretty hard. I bounced off a wall, and then the cow kicked me again. I still remember thinking, when will this stop? My mother taught me to work from that early age. She would instruct me to collect ladybugs from plants in the garden, count them, and then put them back in the garden. I guess I learned to count that way. It was useless make work, of course, but this was the era of Roosevelt, and make work hadn't yet developed a bad reputation. From the time I was 5, I was doing real chores around the farm. Often I worked under the wing of my brother, Dick, who was a year older and a lot bigger. When he wasn't beating me up, he was telling me what to do. It was my job to feed the calves buttermilk. And since we didn't have buckets with nipples in those days, I used my hands. Every weekend, I'd have to clean the calf barn of manure. In the winter, it froze, and that could make the work particularly unpleasant. I still remember a time when I was about 7, working in the fields late on a frigid afternoon. I allowed myself to cry a few tears, and my father told me, "You might as well grit your teeth, because crying only's going to slow you down, and we're not quitting till we're finished." It was a lesson I burned into my heart. At 8 or 9, I began milking cows and branding calves. At 10, I learned how to castrate calves. At harvest time, I'd work long past dark cutting the grain. I'd rake hay and stack it and learn to drive a tractor and a team of horses. I worked every day of the year but 2, July 4th and Christmas. On those days, all I had to do was feed the animals, and that took just a few hours. So I looked forward to those holidays with great patriotism and Christian feeling, respectively. All the years of my childhood, the Lyman family spent cherished evenings together, sitting around and listening to my father read the Saturday Evening Post aloud to us. When I was in high school, the family got its first TV. Now, we had a new kind of family evening at home. All of us gathered around in the den, watching the test pattern. The future looked bright indeed. When we weren't farming or getting absorbed in test patterns, Dick and I liked to grab a couple of 22 caliber rifles and go out and shoot anything that moved, and a few things that didn't. We shot deer and elk, which we skinned and ate. We shot all kinds of birds, sparrows, crows, magpies, killdeer, curlews, partridge. When we had an infestation of gophers, we shot 1,000 in a day. Once in a particularly renegade mood, we shot the glass insulation off all the local power lines. From our point of view, those damn things were just hanging up there, practically asking for it. It was a point of view the sheriff didn't quite share. At the end of his sophomore year in high school, Dick developed a swelling of his lymph glands. He was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. In those days, the disease was always fatal. We didn't talk about it much in my family, but it was a quiet fact around which much of our lives revolved. From that point on, Dick always did exactly what he wanted to do, and nobody questioned him. He loved the woods more than anything, and he'd go hunting and fishing at the drop of a hat. I stayed behind and did more than my share of the farm work. When he was a junior in high school, Dick got married, and he had a child in his senior year. He was living hard and fast. My confidence in my farming future stood behind the disastrous academic record I achieved in high school. I excelled in football, but I didn't do much else well. I cut classes right and left and graduated only, I suspect, because my teachers didn't particularly want to see my mug around anymore. I'd always gone to school in the morning with manure on my boots, and my respect for the institution was such that I felt that there was more on my boots on the way home. So I was delighted to be out of school and back on the farm I loved. But when my father, nervous about the prospect of my someday taking over the 540-acre spread, prevailed upon me to look seriously at all the business aspects of not just working on a farm, but actually running it, I realized how ill-equipped I was. I lacked most of the skills that were necessary for steering a modern business. I decided to do what any self-respecting, red-blooded American boy does, who's partied and daydreamed his way through 12 years of school without learning a damn thing. I went to college. My grandfather had told me that he had connections back east. He claimed he could even get me into Harvard. I had too much respect for the Ivy League to take him up on it. I resolved to handle my future myself. I packed up what I owned, which was about all I had ever owned, one pair of boots, one pair of pants, and two shirts. And I headed off for Montana State University. I never sent home for money. I covered the cost of all 4 years of my higher education by playing poker. Although I was pretty good at it, living off poker can be a nip-and-tuck affair. Luckily, I wasn't born with an overly expressive face. I wasn't about to repeat at university the mistake I had made in high school. This time, I paid attention and did my homework. I took courses at the College of Agriculture. It was an exciting time to be launching into agricultural studies. We learned to spurn the old-fashioned, inefficient methods of farming, the organic methods of my father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. There was not one course offered in organic agriculture. In its place, a bold new age of chemically enhanced agriculture was dawning. We learned the most up-to-date methods of using pesticides and herbicides, hormones, and antibiotics. My professors were all chemists and academicians, well, without an hour's worth of real farming experience among them. These guys were so good at what they did, I figured, they didn't even have to get their hands dirty. I bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. After college, I signed up for a stint in the Army. Since I had already completed ROTC in college, the Army had no choice but to make me an officer. I found myself having a damn good time. I had to work only 5.5 days a week, and I made more money playing poker on my off time than I got paid for being a soldier. After the kind of work I was used to on the farm, my basic training in Fort Knox was a piece of cake, and I didn't have to worry about the weather or the price of milk. When I was hungry, they fed me. The accommodations were fine, especially at the Hunter Leggett base in California, where it never got cold and the bullshit never froze. As much as I loved farming, I had to admit the Army had it beat for sheer pleasure. If my brother hadn't been sick, I probably would have made a career out of it. But my brother was dying, and I came home. Dick could hardly work. My father was getting older and was burdened with more than he could handle. He didn't cope with stress very well. He needed me to run the farm. I studied the farm's books, which now I could decipher, and I suddenly understood something that had simply never occurred to me before. We were poor. My old man was barely making ends meet. I told him that if I was going to take over this operation, I sure as hell wasn't going to keep running it on a hand-to-mouth basis as an organic dairy farm. I was going to deficit finance, expand, and employ all the brand new chemical farming techniques I'd learned about in college. My father had no choice. He handed over the farm, but as he shook my hand on the deal, he had a few short words for me. He told me I was wrong. Crop rotation was the first principle of the old-fashioned organic method of dairy farming employed by my father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. A field that was used to grow alfalfa one year got planted with, say, wheat the next, and corn the following year. Farmers paid particular attention to nitrogen-fixing crops, like beans or clover or alfalfa, which pulled nitrogen out of the air and put it into the soil, thus naturally fertilizing it. The second principle was leaving fields fallow, usually at least once every few years. Doing so restored moisture into the soil, made weeding simple, and let the microorganisms and earthworms in the soil go to work regenerating it. The third principle, analogous to the second, but concerning animal husbandry, was best expressed in the old farmer saying, "When you raise an animal on grass, take half and leave half." In other words, don't let your cattle overgraze. By leaving roughly half the grass alive in the grazing field, the grass would come back each year, and its roots would hold the soil and protect it from erosion. Finally, farming organically meant working with nature, not against it. Organic agriculture is predicated on doing things on nature's time frame. Crops are harvested when they're ripe, and fields are cut into small sections so that each crop could be picked at its peak condition. These were quaint old ways, and I guess I thought they were good enough for people who didn't know any better, but they sure as hell weren't good enough for an educated young farmer like me. Those of us who had been schooled in the ways of the Green Revolution were going to bury these old methods of farming the way electricity had buried the kerosene lamp. There was a better living to be had through chemistry. I found beauty in the almost mathematical precision of the new chemical agriculture. I would take a hollow tube, 3 feet long and maybe an inch in diameter, and press it into the ground to obtain a soil sample. By bringing the sample to a soil testing lab, I could determine which of the three basic soil nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, were needed in the soil, at what depths and in what percentages. Since our soil was already potassium rich, I might be advised to buy some 80-pound bags of 11480, a fertilizer mixture that was 11% nitrogen, 48% phosphorus, and 0% potassium. Later, I began buying fertilizer in bulk, 200 or 300 tons at a time. I'd spread the fields with this mixture, and it would seep down into the soil like a timed-release medicine. Fertilizing this way worked like a dream, especially after I'd had a few years to fiddle around and discover the best mixtures. I found that by loading the soil with about 100 pounds per acre of 3300 in the spring, and then rotating that with an equivalent amount of 1620 in the fall, I was doubling the yields per acre of all our crops, and I didn't have to waste any acreage by leaving it fallow. I handled the problems of weeds with something called 2,4-D, a chemical weed control product. I just sprayed it throughout the farm, covering 500 or 600 acres a day. If a little was good, more was better. Before long, I was looking for new and more powerful concoctions of 2,4-D. Then I began using an excellent variety of herbicide called 2,4-5-T. In Vietnam, they called it Agent Orange. Once I had the extra crop yield, of course, I was faced with the problem of what to do with it. With the occasional exception of wheat, none of the crops I was raising fetched much of a price on the market. They were more useful as livestock feed, but it was more feed than I needed for the 50 head of cattle I then had. You didn't have to be a brain surgeon to come up with a solution. Buy more cattle. After I acquired more cattle than I could possibly allow to graze on my fields, I simply put them in confinement and converted a grazing operation into a feedlot. I corralled the animals in roofless pens, 100 or 200 in each, with a trough for feed on one side of the pen, and I embraced the fundamental challenge of the feedlot operator: make the cattle grow as big and fat as possible, as quickly as possible. You get paid by the pound, after all. Cattle don't win any prizes for keeping their figures. The more grain you feed them, the fattier and therefore the more tender and pricey their meat becomes. So I learned how to alter my cattle's natural dietary habits. Whereas my father and grandfather raised cattle almost completely on grass and roughage, I now cut out their grazing rights and fed them only roughage, grain, and protein concentrates, gradually increasing the percentage of grain until they were 90% grain-fed. This made their meat extremely fatty and gave it the nice white flecks you see in the better cuts of beef in your grocery stores. This diet also, unfortunately, upsets the cow's natural digestive system, which was designed for grass, not grain. As a consequence of the digestive stress, many of my animals suffered vaginal and rectal prolapses. Organs that belonged on the inside of the cow fell out of them. It was too expensive to call a vet every time this happened, so I spent countless hours stuffing 25 pounds of cow back inside the animal and then sewing the wound, the whole force of a 600-pound heifer straining against me. I have been out of cattle farming for 15 years now, and I will go back to it the day I wake up with a burning desire to perform another bovine rectal prolapse operation. While I was expanding my feedlot operation, I would acquire cattle at auction. I might get 100 head at a single auction from maybe 25 different sources. After transporting them to my ranch, I put them one at a time into a chute to restrain them. Then I cut off their horns, branded them, vaccinated them for various diseases, castrated the males, and locked them in a pen. Unfortunately, with so many animals from different origins concentrated close together, disease became my worst enemy. When I shifted from a grazing operation to a feedlot, the health problems of my herd rose dramatically. It was a constant battle. Economics versus nature. If you don't catch a cow during the first few days, it's symptomatic. There is about a 50% chance it'll die on you. If even 5% of your cattle die, there's no way you'll ever make a profit. Unfortunately, cattle in confinement develop more diseases than you can possibly vaccinate against. In an enclosed space like a cattle pen, even those afflicted cows that successfully respond to a vaccination can pass the germ to other cattle in the process of shedding the disease. So like most feedlot operators, I learned to put antibiotics into the cattle's feed. It would have been too time-consuming to try to target only the sick cattle with the antibiotic-enhanced feed. And anyway, I never knew which cow might get sick tomorrow. It was much easier and more logical to simply put the antibiotics in the feed of all the cattle. Here again, like all other feedlot operators, I was outsmarted by nature, which endowed the bacteria causing these diseases with the capacity to mutate and gain immunity to any antibiotic science can develop. If you use antibiotics sparingly, this is a manageable problem. But once you begin to use them liberally, adding increasing amounts to animal feed, and then injecting more into those cattle that nonetheless fall sick, you invite the resistance that will defeat you over time. Soon I found myself changing antibiotics in the feed every 30 days or so, and they were becoming less and less effective. Constantly experimenting with new and larger quantities of antibiotics at an escalating cost, I felt that I was on a treadmill and I had to keep running faster just to stay in place. Sometimes the drugs that I used to inoculate cattle were eventually determined to be dangerous to human health and were banned. But the government always seemed to be sufficiently cooperative with agribusiness to make sure that the stockpiles of the suspect drug inventoried by the drug companies were sold before the ban went into effect. Once the banned drugs were in farmers' hands, they were used until exhausted. After bovine diseases in their various forms, flies constitute the greatest hazard to feedlot operations. With every cow in a pen producing 25 pounds of manure in a day, the flies can get so thick that they actually threaten a cow's ability to breathe. And cows, restlessly trying to do something about the flies persecuting them, sometimes kick up so much dust that they can contract what is called dust pneumonia. But the great promise of chemical agriculture is that every problem represents merely another challenge to science. And the scientific fix for the fly problem was insecticide. Early in the morning, I would fill up a fly fogger with insecticide and spray great clouds of it over the whole operation. The insecticide would, of course, fall into the feed and the water of the cattle, as well as on the trees and the grass and the crops. In addition, I treated the animals for grubs, the worm-like larvae of certain insects, by covering their backs with insecticides that were absorbed through the skin in order to kill the fly eggs. Naturally, I had neither the time nor the inclination to think about the possibility of this deadly chemical passing through the hide into the tissues that would become somebody's dinner. I handled the chemical operations on the farm without any gloves, goggles, or protective clothing. We young farmers had been taught a lot of marvelous new things at Montana State University, but we hadn't been taught that the products we were using were a danger to our health. To make the cattle grow faster, I didn't restrict myself to merely forcing upon them an unnatural diet of grain. Like most cattle farmers today, I used hormones to stimulate the growth of the animals. These growth hormones are similar to the steroids that misguided muscle builders use at significant risk to their own health. The hormones were either added to the feed, injected directly into the animals, or implanted underneath the hides in the form of time-released pellets. For years, the hormones I used most frequently was dialethylstibestrol, or DES. I used it not only to stimulate growth, but also to abort pregnant heifers. After all, the added weight of a fetus would have been wasted since it wasn't going to become hamburger. During the years that I used the hormone, the debate raged over whether or not DES could be carcinogenic to humans. Finally, in 1977, the government banned the use of DES. But since it was so cheap and effective, many feedlot operators bought up as much product as possible for use after it was no longer available for sale. I regret to say that I was one of them. After my DES ran out, about 2 years after the ban went into effect, I continued to use a whole bunch of new and improved growth hormones. In those days, I never met a chemical I didn't like. It was also illegal to use growth hormones on any cattle that would be slaughtered within 2 weeks of ingesting or being treated with them. This was not exactly a law that I obeyed religiously, and I don't think many other feedlot operators did. In fact, at the current time, all European Union countries banned the import of American beef because of our continued use of growth hormones. Most Americans don't have any idea of the extraordinary lengths the Department of Agriculture goes to in its mission to protect the grower at the expense of the consumer. When a chemical is banned from use, a farmer or livestock operator who has the chemical in stock has a choice, either to lose money by disposing of the product or to use it and take the risk of getting caught breaking the law. How severe is that risk? Well, if you use a banned product in your cattle feed, you have to face the prospect that the government is going to inspect one out of every 250,000 carcasses. They will test this carcass not for all banned substances, but just for a small fraction of them. And even if they detect some residue of a banned substance, and even if they're able to trace the carcass to the ranch that produced it, the guilty rancher is likely at most to receive a stern letter with a strongly worded warning. I never met a rancher who suffered in any way from breaking any regulation meant to protect the safety of our meat. The whole procedure is, in short, a charade. I didn't lose too much sleep over breaking the rules. I had bigger worries. More and more, I had to worry about money. Even though I had increased crop yields dramatically, even though I could now grow a heifer to 1,100 pounds in just 15 months instead of the 30 months it used to take, even though I had bought out or leased many of my neighbors' farms and increased my acreage 40-fold, it was getting harder and harder to make ends meet. The chemicals themselves were expensive, and every year I had to use more chemical fertilizer and more antibiotics to get the same result as the year before. And the cattle continued to get sick and sometimes die in spite of my best efforts. I was working 18-hour days and feeling less and less secure financially. My only stress-relieving social entertainment consisted of poker games once or twice a month in the winter. I played with a group of about 10 men, almost all farmers, and all serious beer drinkers. The games were pure relaxation for all of us at low stakes. Most of us had already placed a high-stakes bet on chemical agriculture, and we didn't have the stomach for much more betting. I had dug myself into a chemical pit so deep I didn't have time to do anything except keep digging. When my brother died of cancer in 1969, I lost a valuable sounding board. I had taken full control of the Lyman Ranch shortly thereafter, buying out my parents' stake, and ever since there had been no check on my actions. Only my wife, Willow Jean, whom I had married in the early years of the transformation of the farm, would occasionally comment to me, "Are you sure we're going in the right direction?" She would note that the trees were starting to die and that in spite of the herbicides, the weed problems seemed to be getting worse. And she wasn't at all pleased the day I came in with so much herbicide on my clothing that my mere presence killed off all her houseplants. I used to have a regular business lunch once a week in Great Falls with a group of about 15 Montana feedlot operators. We were all devotees of the new school of chemical agriculture, and we figured that by getting together and sharing our experiences, we could help each other find the right technological solution for every problem we encountered. We didn't question the underlying theology of our revolution. There would always be a magic chemical bullet to cure whatever problems we ran into. We stuck by that theology in spite of the mounting evidence that every bullet just seemed to cause more problems. Of those 15 feedlot operators who were in business 15 years ago, I believe that just one may still be in business today. Our challenge had been to defeat nature, and we found that we could do it, but only by destroying the land and with it, ourselves. This has been chapter 3 of Howard Lyman's book, Mad Cowboy, Plain Truth from the Cattle Rancher Who Won't Eat Meat. We'll read chapter 4 next time. And we'll look at a few short stories published recently by Sentient Media. The first one is titled, Can Men Help the Climate by Eating Less Meat? The link between masculinity and meat has long shaped men's identities. Could redefining these norms help reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And there's a photo of a man holding up a rack of ribs during the Northern Heat Rib and Beer Festival in Ontario, Canada. Real men eat meat. This gendered stereotype is a longstanding belief seen in many cultures. In the 1950s Mad Men era, marketers pushed the idea that grilling is masculine, and that attitude hasn't changed much by 2025. Today's meat-centric movements, such as the carnivore diet, are branded as symbols of health, strength, and masculinity, and backed by influencers like Andrew Tate and Jordan Peterson. On the other hand, vegetarianism is perceived as feminine, and the long-debunked idea that eating soy alters a man's hormones and even makes him grow breasts is still pervasive. The dietary choices that men make can impact far more than just the image they want to project. Food production is responsible for a third of all global greenhouse gas emissions, with meat being one of the biggest contributors. And because men eat significantly more meat than women, they have a greater climate impact, and this is true all around the world. One study suggests that men's diets are linked to 41% higher greenhouse gas emissions than women's. A 2025 study found that in France, men are responsible for 26% more emissions than women because men eat more red meat and drive more. Our results suggest that traditional gender norms, particularly those linking masculinity with red meat consumption and car use, play a significant role in shaping individual carbon footprints, said Ondine Berland, a co-author of the study and economist at the London School of Economics and Political Science, to The Guardian. But to reduce barriers that prevent men from trying to eat less meat, it's important to understand why they don't want to. Lauren Camilleri, researcher and instructor of psychology at Victoria University in Australia, says that this requires a shift beyond just diet. According to her, the broader culture needs to rewrite the perceived link between men, meat, and power. Meat masculinity and social power. A global shift towards a more plant-rich diet is necessary to meet climate targets and feed the growing human population while minimizing further environmental damage, according to the 2025 Eat Lancet Commission. As efforts to reduce meat consumption develop, many researchers have made men a key focus because their eating habits have the potential for greater climate impact. This is the foundation of Camilleri's research. Her team sought to understand how men's identity and cultural norms may play a role in how much meat they eat and how willing they are to eat less. In a 2023 report on one survey data from men in Australia and England, they identified three profiles of men based on how willing they were to eat less meat. The men surveyed were classified as either resistant to cutting back on meat, meat averse, or ambivalent. Meat was a strong part of the identity of resistant men, who also held the strongest ties to traditional masculine norms and conservative values. Meat-averse men, by contrast, had weak ties to traditional masculinity and felt no threat to their identity by avoiding meat. Most participants fell into the ambivalent group, who are conflicted between ethical concerns and social pressures, being moderately concerned about animal welfare, yet still influenced by the idea that meat symbolizes masculinity. In 2024, Camilleri and her colleagues reported that how strongly a man identifies with specific masculine norms can predict the amount of meat he eats and how willing he is to eat less of it. Men who approved of physical violence and placed high importance on sexual virility tended to eat more meat, especially red meat. And men who had more egalitarian views or more sensitivity to male privilege were most likely to decrease how much meat they eat. Camilleri's team argues that messaging around meat reduction needs to focus on these three profiles separately. Challenging traditional masculine norms may bring about a cultural shift that inspires more men to eat less meat, potentially improving their health and mitigating climate change, they say. Broader cultural concern. Nearly 2 years after publishing her latest research on the link between masculine identity and meat eating, Camilleri's perspective on those research outcomes has evolved. She now believes it is more critical to consider the broader culture that fosters a toxic form of masculinity. Her forthcoming research explores how cultural ideas of masculinity contribute to men's resistance to meat reduction. She writes, adding on to her previous findings, "It's more apparent to me now that the bigger issue or problem is the broader sociocultural environment that we're in," says Camilleri, "and the influence this has on cultural norms and notions around masculinity and what is acceptable and not acceptable behavior." Regarding the ambivalent group, for example, Camilleri explains that even though this group of people in the middle have moral reservations about meat consumption, it bothers them. The ethical issues associated with eating meat, the broader cultural environment, makes it incredibly difficult for people to make those individual level changes. So while behavioral science research offers messaging strategies to make eating less meat more appealing to men, Camilleri believes that what's really necessary is a cultural movement towards more empathy and openness. The 2025 Eat Lancet Commission report argues along similar lines, highlighting that shifts in sociocultural relationships with food can affect change in the global food system in order to meet climate targets and safeguard human health. We need to create sociocultural conditions that make it easier for people to adopt more alternative eating practices, Camilleri says. Particularly for men, changing the culture, the dominant forms of masculinity. The research shows, she adds, that men who are more open to nonviolence, to equality, gender egalitarianism, feminist ideas and ideologies, they're more open to reducing their meat consumption. Reframing the cultural equation that ties masculinity to meat holds the potential to drive meaningful climate progress. While men who have more accepting attitudes towards being violent are more likely to eat meat, Camilleri believes that promoting more empathy, principles of nonviolence, gender equality, things like that in society, in schools, will over time lead to more openness. This article was written by Jessica Scott Reed. Urban foragers are mapping edible plants around the world. Another story from Sentient Media, written by Grace Hussein. The nonprofit Falling Fruits interactive crowdsourced map helps people identify food growing in public spaces that might otherwise go to waste. Ethan Welty and Caleb Phillips originally started Falling Fruit so they could keep track of edible plants in their city. The two are avid foragers, often sourcing their fruits and vegetables for free from city streets and public spaces. Foraging can help people save money and prevent food waste. And for Welty, one of the biggest benefits of Falling Fruits is that it can help people learn about the different plants that have some sort of edible use in their city. For instance, it's a useful tool in community education programs like urban foraging trips, as well as in classes that teach people how to prepare the foraged fruits and vegetables they brought home, says Garrett Broad, associate professor in communications at Rowan University. Since launching in 2013, Falling Fruit has mapped over 4,000 different species of edible mushrooms and plants, including fruit trees, berries, and herbs across almost 2 million publicly accessible foraging spots in cities around the world. To some extent, Welty tells Sentient, it turns the city into an arboretum. Cities get involved. Zooming in on Billings, Montana, the falling fruit map reveals edible plants clustered within the city's parks. These plants are part of the city's Parkland Gleaning Project to give excess harvest to neighbors facing hunger. Starting in 2018, the city's Parks and Recreation Department added dozens of fruiting plants, including chokeberries, cherry bushes, and also pear and apple trees, to 9 of their public parks and used falling fruit to map them. The purpose of the project is making sure that you can go out during these times and glean and have access to these apples, plums, these little berries. Nick Miller, the city's forestry and natural resources supervisor, tells Sentient, "It's a nice service that we offer the public, and it's important for people to take advantage of it. When the program was first launched, it made a splash on the local food scene. For a while, you could head out into Billings and get yourself a chokeberry latte," he says. "Others would turn the berries into flour and make this really neat purple and white sourdough loaf that was kind of tart. But then with the right jam on it, it was amazing." Today, Miller says there's less awareness surrounding the city's gleaning program, but that's something he wants to see change. His goal is to add more plants while increasing outreach, including sourcing and sharing recipes from residents to help make preparing the different fruits more accessible. The interactive map offers details for foraging, but more than that, people can use it to learn about their neighborhoods, Broad says. The community programs that Miller envisions can have a bigger impact when paired with the falling fruit map. The website itself focuses a lot on just kind of putting the information out there, says Broad. But when you get a community together, you can use it as a way to learn more about their local community, learn about agricultural history, learn about ways to use a particular crop, and prepare that crop. Creating and maintaining the map. The map of almost 2 million locations was a group effort with input from volunteers, community groups, and individuals. While the platform was started and inspired by his experience as a forager, Welty has learned a lot over the decade that it's been live. With an annual user base of around 300,000, Welty has found that the map's users have a range of needs. "We've learned that we can't really anticipate what people want to find," Welty says, "so they have to stay flexible. You know, we set a pretty broad definition of what is edible, but everyone's definition is different. And some people's definition is very broad," he adds. "Some want mushrooms, fruits, and vegetables they can find in the grocery store, whereas others may be more interested in medicinal plants. Now, all new locations imported to the map are kept regardless of how niche, and there is an option to enable a filter for more commonly consumed plants." Welty has been working on falling fruit for more than a decade, and over the years, his ability to commit significant chunks of time to the project has waxed and waned. Now, as a full-time father with a full-time job, he can only spend a few hours a week working on it. It's why he's been building a dedicated group of core volunteers to support the growing project. Falling Fruit is completely sustained by app sales, with annual expenses sitting at about $2,000. The app costs $1 to download and rakes in roughly $6,000 per year, allowing the nonprofit to pay its operating costs and build up savings. Welty and the other volunteers are preparing for the next phase of Falling Fruit, including the launch of a new website with additional features such as more details on seasonality. Ultimately, Welty hopes that these updates to Falling Fruit can grow the demand so that we can start to affect change and design our cities differently in the future, he says. "Most of the vegetation in the city is actually planted, and so that's an opportunity for a more edible landscape." And here's one more story from Sentient Media for today. Costco chicken processing plant keeps failing tests for salmonella. Costco's Nebraska plant turns out contaminated chicken, and the USDA can't stop it from reaching store shelves. Costco is famous for its $5 roasted chickens, but customers might want to pay attention to its raw chicken products. A new report finds the retailer's Nebraska slaughter and processing plant has a remarkably high salmonella risk, even compared with similarly sized U.S. chicken companies. The report by advocacy group Farm Forward is based on an analysis of USDA Food Safety and Inspection Service inspection data from 2020 to 2024 and focuses on Costco's Lincoln Premium Poultry Chicken Slaughter and Processing Plant in Fremont, Nebraska. The plant slaughters over 100 million chickens annually for its rotisserie chicken and Kirkland's signature raw chicken brand and reportedly supplies about 40% of Costco's chicken. Since Costco's Fremont plant opened in 2019, it has consistently failed the USDA's monthly rolling tests for salmonella, receiving the worst Category 3 rating 92% of the time, the report says. Over a more recent period, from September 2023 through July 2025, the Fremont plant received a Category 3 rating 100% of the time. The director of Farm Forward, Andrew DeCrolis, tells Sentient, suggesting that contamination rates are getting worse. Consumer Reports also includes that Costco plant along its most contaminated poultry plants in the U.S. based on data collected through July 26, 2025. When a plant fails the USDA's salmonella test, the agency does not have the authority to stop the plant's operation, stop raw meat from reaching store shelves, or recall raw meat products. The contaminated chicken can still be sold in grocery stores across the country. In April this year, the USDA withdrew a proposed framework that would have made it illegal to sell poultry products contaminated with one of three major serotypes or variations of salmonella. The report shows that the Lincoln plant has been in Category 3 consistently from September 2023 to July 2025, DeCrolis explains in an email. The only U.S. chicken company with an equally high rate of contamination is Grimaud Farms, which is a custom processor of various poultry and not a retail chicken company. A USDA Category 2 rating allows up to 15.4% of a plant's products to be contaminated in the case of chicken parts and up to 9.8% in the case of whole chickens. Any plants whose chicken parts are more than 15.4% contaminated or whose whole chickens are more than 9.8% contaminated are given a Category 3 rating. A Category 3 rating has no upper limit for salmonella contamination. This means, DeCrolis says, we wouldn't know if a plant failed at 15.5% or 99% contamination. But when a plant fails a salmonella test with a Category 3 rating, the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service has no authority to stop it from continuing to operate or sell the contaminated chickens. The USDA does not have the authority to enforce the salmonella standards it sets, the Farm Forward report says. Even when levels of salmonella contamination are extreme, it cannot order recalls, stop the sale of contaminated products, or suspend or shut down plants. Farm Forward plans to provide comment at a January 14th USDA public hearing on how the agency might improve salmonella regulations going forward. DeCarolis says when his team began looking at the salmonella contamination rates, he was taken aback by the levels allowed by the USDA. As a consumer, if you go into the grocery store, I think you would be surprised, shocked, maybe horrified to learn that 1 in 10 packages of chicken products could be contaminated, he says, and that is deemed by safety regulators as acceptable. The risks to Costco shoppers are more concentrated, DeCarolis says, because of the retailer's highly integrated supply chain, unlike other chicken plants which sell to a range of retailers. No other retailer in the U.S. has a vertically integrated chicken company like Lincoln Premium Poultry, whose chicken is sold only at Costco, says DeCarolis. By contrast, DeCarolis says that while Perdue, a major U.S. poultry company, had three plants rated as Category 3 in 2023 and 2024. It sells to hundreds of different outlets, diluting the risk at each individual retailer. The Fremont, Nebraska plant accounts for about 40% of the chickens sold at Costco, according to WhatPoultry.com's poultry company's database. Costco did not respond to Sentient's request for comment on the Farm Forward report. The high level of salmonella contamination in Costco's Fremont chickens, the report says, could be connected to poor welfare conditions such as overcrowding or stressful transport and handling conditions, which can weaken birds' immune systems. Farm Forward's analysis found that during the same time Costco received Category 3 salmonella ratings, the company was also cited for humane handling violations, supporting evidence that poor welfare contributes to higher contamination. Stress in animals has a significant adverse effect on food safety, according to a USDA fact sheet, which says that exposure of farmed animals to stressors will lead to increased levels of foodborne pathogens in the gastrointestinal tract and increased risk of contamination of their carcasses. Costco's humane handling and transportation violations reported by the USDA included 2,000 chickens freezing to death in trailers on their way to the plant, 1,000 birds who were in a truck dying in a fire, and 1,600 birds dying after they were left without food and water in conditions of extreme overcrowding. DeCarola says the report's findings are particularly disturbing, giving Costco's control over its supply chain and the power it has to change things for the better. Costco has 100% control. They get to decide how the birds are raised. They get to decide what genetics are used. They get to decide how the birds are killed. They get to decide 100% of what goes on in these operations. And right now, they're choosing the worst option. We hope you enjoyed today's installment of Animalia Hour with me, Sarah Hale. We'll be back next week with more news and stories. Wishing you a gorgeous day. Bye.